Best Moments episode of Futures Radio Show, sponsored by CME Group, the world's leading and most diverse futures and options exchange. CME Group's markets help individuals and businesses around the world effectively manage risk. For access to free educational tools and resources for the active individual trader, please visit activetrader.cmegroup.com.
Every day, traders and investors dive in to tackle the ever-changing markets to find opportunity. Futures Radio Show is your number one source for answers to the questions that all market participants want to ask. Veteran futures trader Anthony Crudelli sits down with the most influential leaders and top traders in the industry. Now, here's your host, Anthony Crudelli.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the newest episode of Futures Radio Show, where we will highlight our favorite moments of the show over the past month. But before we get started, I want to thank all of our sponsors: CME Group, Trading Technologies, RJO Futures, and Top Step Trader. So without further ado, let's dial into those top moments of the show this month. Talk to us about how someone goes about getting fundamentals on these crypto assets.
Yeah, so it is interesting working for a company and that is purely kind of playing the TA world in terms of we have all the indicators out there that you'd ever want. And it is a little bit interesting for myself to say, okay, on the back end of things, we do have to look at this asset as an actual asset and try to see if there's any fundamental valuation that can really be applied here. So I know you mentioned some of the stuff from Chris Berninski in his book. I would say that's probably the gospel, if you will, when it comes to kind of fundamental research and diving deep into that, and some of the stuff they're doing now at Placeholder is really, really interesting for myself. But looking at it further, I mean, there is a lot of research, whether it be academia, VCs, kind of token funds. Everybody's kind of looking at this and saying, okay, what does this currency want to be? Just like you value a stock differently from a commodity, from a bond to a currency and everything, we've got to value these cryptos differently based on what they want to be. So one of the first questions I kind of look at with Bitcoin, namely, is what does Bitcoin want to be? And I don't think anybody really knows right now because there is a lot of development going on and a lot of changes within the ecosystem, but there's kind of two ways to look at it. A, Bitcoin will be a store of value, so a long-term store of value, a deflationary asset that's going to accrete value over time, much like gold is the easy one to point at. Alternatively, Bitcoin is going to be a payment system. I would tell you that some of the people at Lightning Network and kind of the second layer services that are trying to increase throughput would probably be in that camp. So looking at it from a store of value perspective, you can say, okay, is this a good store of value? I would say arguably it's a very good store of value if you look at kind of its lifetime values up a gazillion percent. And if you look at it from a payment perspective, you look at it from a transaction kind of volume and what is this kind of doing in today's world as a currency. So the fundamental one is interesting. You can look at the cost of mining a Bitcoin and what does that mean from an opportunity cost, and that kind of brings fundamental value to it for a store of value, because over time miners are still going to have to mine it and they have to bring some value to it. And you can say, okay, maybe this takes over gold. A percentage of gold's market kind of turns into Bitcoin because it's better at being moved. It's more anonymous. It's easier to transfer. It's more liquid, arguably. And you can say maybe in 7 years, Bitcoin will take over, let's just say 50%. You can discount that back depending on the growth rates you apply to gold's market value and the discounts rate you use for your investment thesis. And I ran some models on this, and it comes out to like $75,000 per Bitcoin based on current market assumptions and discount rate of like 15% or something. So there is a compelling story there in terms of it just takes over gold. Ignore silver and all the other store values or precious jewelry or anything like that. So there is a compelling story there from a store value perspective. The more interesting one for myself, because I'm probably in the camp of Bitcoin wants to become a currency, because I think that's probably what the white paper originally intended, considering the fact that the title was like a peer-to-peer cash system. And if you look at it that way, currencies by nature, or all currencies to date, again, we don't know what the future is going to be like, but all currencies to date have been kind of inflationary assets that their value over time is going to go down, their purchasing power is going to go down. Bitcoin's quite a bit different there. So we're going to look at it a little bit differently because it doesn't have a GDP. There is no central bank controlling it. The inflation is a weird thing to think about right now because there is no applied interest rate on it. There's really no purchasing power benchmarks to look at it over time because it's just a young asset. So one of the more interesting things, I think this came out of Crypto Lab and Willy Wu on Twitter, was this idea of like an NVT ratio, which is essentially the network value, so the entire market cap essentially of Bitcoin, compared to basically the number of transactions and transaction volume being sent through it. So if you think about it, if I want to purchase a Bitcoin and use it as a currency, I have to enter the market, and that's going to bid up the price. As more and more people use the currency, there has to be more entry into the market, therefore increasing the price. Over time, this ratio has hovered between like 25 and probably 85 is kind of the healthy range, is when kind of Bitcoin was kind of steadily going up over time. You had the big bubble back in 2014. We reached like 177 on the ratio, and we crashed very, very quickly back down in Bitcoin. The scary thing today is that we all thought we had that big correction coming out of January where we hit 19, 20,000. Now we're down to 6, 6.5. And we think, okay, maybe this is a good consolidation zone. If you look at it from a fundamental basis, the NVT ratio, so the number or the ratio that measures Bitcoin as an actual fundamental asset being used for a fundamental reason, a currency, for example, is actually still far above the historical average, and it's around 180 right now on a rolling 30-day basis or so. So Bitcoin, even though the price has gone down 70-75% arguably, the transactions are still quite anemic, and there's really not, it's not really being used as a currency, which is pretty scary from a fundamental kind of perspective, because there is arguably still quite a ways to fall for the price, or alternatively, I mean, every ratio has two sides, the payment mechanism of Bitcoin has to increase quite a bit to meet kind of the current network value.
Let's talk a little bit about what's going on with you and market technology at CME Group. Can you talk through some of the latest business initiatives you are focused on at CME and why?
Yeah, I would love to. So, you know, to kind of tell you where we've been focused, it's probably good to start at one of our baseline products called CME Datamine. And CME Datamine has been around for a number of years. It's where CME Group hosts its historical collection of market data going back to like the 1970s. And, you know, that's really important for a number of reasons. You know, you can get end-of-day data, market depth data, number of time and sales data, number of data sources, from there across all of our products, you know, like I said, going back decades. But where we really evolved the platform in the last couple of years, and I certainly cannot take all the credit for that. There's lots of team members, you know, Adam Monterey, Dave Gresky, Craig Mohan, that have had the vision and foresight around this platform to help build it out. But where we've taken it is it's now a web-based portal where customers can access Datamine online. And so they can call up their data that they'd like to see. So the reason, you know, folks do, you know, take a look at Datamine data is because they want to potentially test, you know, strategies out and use historical data, you know, to help do that in a new market that they may be foraying into. And so to be able to call up that data online, because we actually store the data, which is a nuance in the last couple of years, year and a half, in the cloud. And so where this is really revolutionary is that we used to get the data orders through the phone. I think we at one point like took PayPal and faxed paperwork back and forth between customers and had like one person really focused on, you know, sales, which, you know, is in the millions with regards to that business. And we really, you know, wanted to improve the customer experience. And so having them call it up on the web-based portal and be able to have data in a matter of minutes, you know, if they, you know, get through the paperwork and, you know, get their shopping cart, you know, full and make their decisions pretty quickly, was pretty revolutionary. Because what we used to also do is we would mail, so you'd call up this guy on the phone, you'd fill out your paperwork, you'd send your PayPal through, and then we'd ship you a hard drive maybe a week or two later, containing all the data. So to have, like I said, now this most efficient way to store and deliver the data, you know, we're very proud of where we have come. You know, and what's really exciting about that as far as some of the latest initiatives is that we have launched an alternative data business. And by alternative, I do not mean radical. I just mean different. And so different from, you know, the norm, you know, market data sources. And so what we're seeing over the last, you know, couple of years are companies coming out with different types of data sources that are, you know, mapping to, you know, market movements or, you know, market products. And so what CME Group is very focused on is we want to work with products that are akin to our marketplace. So there's tons and tons of alternative data sources out there. They can apply, you know, to multiple, you know, verticals across the industries. You know, certainly some apply more on the equity side than, you know, the future side, depending on the product set. So what we try to do is go out and, you know, the sales team, the market technology sales team goes out and they look for specific data producers that have data sets that would be really relative to our market players. And the role we're trying to play is get those data sets into CME DataMine so that our, you know, very large distribution base of customers have a single portal to say, you know, these are potential data sets that we have done, you know, data science evaluation on and have found that, you know, there are good correlations to this data set and CME Group's data. Now, I will say that, you know, traders are responsible for their own trading strategies around that, but we do look at the data sets and make sure that there, you know, there are correlations. We've launched a couple that we've talked about now for a few months, Orbital Insight Energy, which provides access to global and regional crude oil volume estimates. And then we've also talked about TELUS Labs, which is a crop health index. And both of them are satellite-based companies that, you know, kind of help do predictive analytics, whether it be in oil storage capacity or, you know, plant conditions as it pertains to TELUS Labs. But, you know, we're really excited because our two most recent data sources that we are just announcing into DataMine is a company called RS Metrics, and they have a product called Metal Signals Copper, which provides data on satellite imagery-based trends and estimates of global copper production and storage. And, you know, that type of data can be found, you know, daily, weekly, monthly, year over year, you know, and gives estimations growth in raw materials as well as finished products stored, you know, outside approximately about 100 global copper smelters, I think is what they're called, and storage facilities. So very, very, you know, cool for our metals, you know, suite of products to take a look at. And then we've also been working with a company called Bantix. Some people may know Bantix because they provide the QuickStrike application and CME Group's front-end application, but they also, in DataMine, are going to provide access to QuickStrike end-of-day implied volatility curves for about 40 CME Group products via its QuickVol historical volatility tool. I know that's a mouthful, but basically these are new data sets that include both listed and constant maturity expiration curves, as well as realized historical volatility for all related futures products. So for folks focusing in, you know, options, it could be a really unique data set for them to take a look at. And so, you know, those are some things that we've been working on from an alternative data perspective for, I'd say, over a year now. We've been working on a baseline contract, getting DataMine ready, and understanding how we want to take on this business. But most importantly, we've been doing a ton of customer research to validate the direction that, you know, we had opted to take with the data producers and, you know, how CME Group could play a role.
I want to talk about institutional investing a little bit. I think it was Jameson Lopp or Pomp. They put a tweet out saying Bitcoin doesn't need institutional investors. Institutional investors need Bitcoin. So I want to know what you think about that. And also, what are some factors institutional investors may want to consider with respect to adding exposure to these crypto assets and blockchain technology?
Sure. Well, I like that tweet. So I think, you know, from an institutional standpoint, I think it's important to think about the opportunity cost of waiting to invest. So waiting for these markets to become more mature, waiting for more infrastructure to get built in. Because I think there's a tremendous amount of opportunity now, and if you wait for the industry to mature, you may give up some of that potential for upside appreciation. I think institutional investors need to get comfortable with the volatility of this asset class. Now, I don't know for certain, but I would guess that many crypto hedge funds were down 40 to 50% during the last couple of quarters. That is not something you see very often with a traditional hedge fund. So I think institutional investors need to think about how they want to manage that. I also think sizing can be interesting. With the volatility we had last fall, if a manager allocated a small portion of its portfolio to the crypto space, suddenly that small portion became a very large allocation. Of course, that sizing may have then taken care of itself the last couple of quarters when the markets went down, but it's something to think about. And then broadly speaking, you know, I think there's a lot of value that may come from these new protocols that won't necessarily accrue over into the equity markets. So if you're investing in traditional equities and the S&P, and if a protocol like our chain or Tezos becomes hugely successful, I don't think that value shifts over to the traditional equities markets necessarily. From a trading standpoint, you know, this is still largely a retail marketplace. So in a sense, you have a lot of retail investors who are willing to give you their alpha. So from a trading standpoint, I think that's always interesting.
One of the things I want to talk about today is the financial transaction tax. I mean, this is just one of those things that can have a massive impact on the financial industry. So if you could tell everybody who's proposing the financial transaction taxes and what they're proposing.
Sure. So Senator Bernie Sanders has introduced, you know, each of the Groundhog Day, he keeps on introducing this bill, the Inclusive Prosperity Act. The most recent one is Bill S-805. And, you know, it's been billed as a law that would, you know, make Wall Street pay its fair share. And what it does is it taxes futures at half a basis point, bonds at 10 basis points, and then equities at 50 basis points. But when you, you know, really look closely at the numbers and run the numbers, it actually has a much bigger impact than just, you know, penalizing Wall Street. It really ends up, at the end of the day, hitting home a lot of the unions and their pension funds.
So Kirsten, you've talked about pension funds, but what about the individual investors? And if you could, give us an example of maybe how this financial transaction tax would impact their portfolio.
So an individual investor, if they had a mutual fund holdings of, let's say, $100,000 held over their working life of 40 years, well, they would be estimated to pay $48,000 in financial transaction tax fees. And that's because it's in a mutual fund. Each dollar isn't just held for those 40 years, but each mutual fund has a turnover rate. This is estimating a 50% turnover rate, which is conservative. Some mutual funds have a much higher, you know, 80% or over 100% turnover rate. So that $48,000 is a modest estimate of the impact.
I mean, this is why traders out there are listening to this. It's so important to stay on top of what's happening with politics, as much as we don't really like it, you know, you're talking about that could, like I said, this could have a massive impact. So I know at MMI, you guys educate the public on these types of things. So what are you guys doing to educate traders and investors so they're aware of what's going on?
Sure. So we have been pretty active in, I'd say, educating the pension fund community. You know, there are 15 million union workers in the country that rely on their pension funds. So we've really been active with that. And we've also published a series of op-eds. And actually, just in August, we're coming out with a study that will publish kind of indicating some of the key results of how this financial transaction tax would really hit the savings community.
So what do you see happening?
So what I see is this. I mean, it seems like a really small tax, right? And the proponents of it are like, well, you wouldn't know the difference. It's just 50 basis points. It's just a couple pennies on whatever the trade is. But actually, when you look at these, like pension funds in particular, as large aggregators of investment, you know, if you can look at one of the biggest federal employee pension funds, and they would be hit with $250 million annually in this tax alone. And then you look at you know, if you have a local tiny pension fund with $2 billion in assets under management, they'd be hit with $4 million a year. And then when you look at some of the larger pension funds, like there's a New York City employee pension fund, it's like five different, you know, employee unions, they'd be hit with over $1 billion a year in taxes. California pension fund, almost $1 billion as well. So you're looking at pretty large numbers, and especially for pension funds, some of these are already teetering on, you know, trying to pay off the benefits of so many people who are retiring, and they're trying to manage their investments efficiently. And this is something that, you know, is seen by that community, I think, as a real setback.
Hey, everyone. I hope you're enjoying the show so far, but I want to pause and thank one of our sponsors, Trading Technologies. I started using TT in the year 2000, and I love it. It is by far the best trading platform I have ever used, and I've tried a lot of them. With TT, you can trade the global markets from virtually anywhere in the world. They are the world's fastest commercially available futures trading platform. I highly suggest you go try out TT, especially because you can try it for free. Just go to tryttnow.com and set up your account. You know, thinking about you with your kid now and, you know, building a startup, like you said, I really don't have a lot going on. I want to talk about the grind of entrepreneurship. Nothing is handed to you as an entrepreneur, and all you do at the beginning is write checks. You don't cash them. So talk to us about how the grind has been for you.
You know, it's a great question. People think a lot of times entrepreneurship is just all about kind of like the way you look and getting up on Forbes magazine and posting out on LinkedIn, this and that, and the other thing, and make yourself kind of portraying this brand of who you are. I'll tell you what, I really love what I do. I have a passion for what I do. I believe we're making a difference. But you know what? Every single morning I wake up and I'm like, heck, I've got to pull myself to do this. And why? It's because it's so hard. It's so hard. It's not the magazine covers, right? It's not TechCrunch. That is the pick of everything else. I think that real entrepreneurs, the ones that succeed, are the ones that don't give up easily, and the ones that are the 90% of the iceberg underneath the water that really have it in them to hustle every single day. Gosh. It is a grind. It is a grind when you're dealing with so much uncertainty, ambiguity, with the solution in the market, the problem that you're solving, raising venture capital, doing 20 things at one time. I would say it's the most challenged I've ever been. But I would also say it's the most rewarding place that I have been in my career, without a doubt.
How did you go about picking the traders for the book?
So, let's say I had a head start. So I knew Michael Marcus, who was chapter one of the first Horses book, and Michael had the analytical. You know, my first job in Wall Street was a research analyst, and Michael was leaving that position, and I was replacing him, and he was leaving to become a trader. We met, you know, when he was moving his stuff out and I was moving in, and we talked a little bit, and then he was still in New York for a few years, and we used to get together regularly for lunch, you know, and stuff, and then he got a trading job, and I quickly discovered that he had a great talent for trading, and was no matter how much work I would do, you know, he was always, you know, whenever we disagreed on anything, he was right, I was wrong. So, anyway, I kept in touch with him, and he went on to Commodities Corp, and he became phenomenally successful. So by the time I did Market Wizards, he had literally turned this $30,000 account they gave him into $80 million. And he had done that with them pulling out 20, 30% a year for expenses. So this is a guy who, and this, of course, the markets were right for his style and everything else, but he was making triple-digit returns, you know, year in, year out. I think he might have, wouldn't be surprised if he had years with four-digit returns. He was just incredible. But in any case, I knew him. I also knew Bruce Kovner, because Bruce Kovner was hired by Michael and was also a client. And I was actually hired by Michael after I did the sabbatical, before I went back to Wall Street again. I worked at Commodities Corp as for Michael, you know, for a little over a year. So I knew him through that. So I had the Commodities Corp Association. So I knew Michael and Bruce, who are both in Market Wizards, and arguably two of the best traders ever. And then through them I got Ed Sakota through Michael Marcus, because Michael Marcus, after I interviewed Michael, he was reluctant to do the interview, finally agreed. We spent a whole day, literally a full day, interviewing through, walking, sitting, meals, everything, and just kept the tape recorder running. But at the end of that, end of the day, after we had dinner that was cooked by his chef, he pushes a chair back and he says, you should speak to Sakota. And I said, who the hell said Sakota? And he says, well, he's the best trader I know. So when some guy who's turned 30,000 to 80 million tells you about the best trader they know, you're interested. And so he got Ed on the phone, and instead of going back to New York, I changed my flights, and Ed agreed to do it, and sort of flew out to Nevada to interview Ed. So, there's like three as an example. There are other people, and every time I interviewed somebody, I would ask if they had if they had any recommendation. There were some people that I just knew of, like Jim Rogers. I knew Jim Stord was teaching a course in Columbia, and so what I did is I sent him my first book, A Complete Guide to the Futures Market. Say, hey, Jim, I'm not a journalist. I'm really, somebody who's, interested in markets. And I want to do this book. And I explained, in the letter with the book, and he agreed. And so, that was the way I kind of pieced it together. But I did have a head start. If I didn't know anybody, it would have been, maybe it would have been impossible to do.
So no fundamentals at all, intraday trading, top-down approach, market profile, some VWAP and other things. So give us the one thing that you believe within your technical strategy that gives you the edge over someone else.
So first of all, if I could quickly, and this may be helpful to some, just kind of quickly define an edge, because I think that word gets a little bastardized from time to time. It can mean different things. I really mean like a positive expectancy, like a mathematical formula of that combination of really two key things that going to make it up an edge in combination. Okay. And that is the win percent, how often you're correct. And then the ratio of the size of your average winning trade compared to your average losing trade. If you've got those pieces of information, you can calculate whether you have an edge or not, okay? So for me, what gives me an edge, it's very multifaceted, but I could really care less about the win percent side of the equation. In fact, long-running history of my trading results put me at around a 45% win percent trader. So essentially, I'm wrong most of the time, okay? But what that contextual piece allows me to do and understanding truly the way markets work, the market dynamics, as I call them, identifying if this, then that, and being able to see where the market's likely to go as a destination and where it's not, that, my friend, frames the risk-reward side of the equation, which then frames, as long as you execute your strategy properly, your average winner compared to your average loser. So that's where my edge truly comes from. I really, really strongly believe in randomness in markets, like really, really deep down. I don't just admit it on like a kind of a conscious level, but deep down subconsciously to my core being, and I think I've had to develop this out of necessity to be a profitable trader, I believe in that randomness. I truly believe that I do not know and can never truly know what's going to happen next. And in fact, my outcome, my stats show me that I'm a coin flip trader, whether I'm right or wrong. But I put true market generated risk reward in my favor. And by the way, not to get on a soapbox here, but a lot of traders I talk to, they create risk reward out of thin air. You know what I mean?
Yes.
They're like, okay, well, my stop's always 10 cents, so I take profit at 20 cents for my 2-to-1. You're just creating that like magic. You've got to learn how to identify true risk reward present at any point in time for a market.
Thank you for listening to Futures Radio Show. If you have any questions or comments for myself or my guests, please visit futuresradioshow.com and sign up to be a premium member for free. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes.